Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. Welcome back. It's April 30th, 2018. I'm Bryce Castillo, filling in for Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Fresh from Canada.
I'll tell you what, I had a hell of an adventure, a long trip back home, but I made it back just in time to catch that Avengers movie.
And Justin Robert Young.
I haven't heard of it.
You haven't heard of it?
No. I'm sorry. I don't watch TV.
TV.
It's my favorite miniseries. Thanks for joining us again, guys. We've got some weird news stories here. I want everybody to look around them. Just double check that you're all fine. Make sure you don't have any cricks in your necks.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, like, look to your left, look to your right. one of those people will be dead before this episode is over.
No, I want you guys to just make sure you're all your fingers and toes are here. Make sure, you know, you don't have any whiplash, because our galaxy was possibly in a collision.
Are we gonna have a lawsuit against another galaxy? we have delayed effects. I would like to formally sue Andromeda. Who did we run into? Wait, Andromeda's set for a head on next, right?
Well, we don't quite know. So, if you don't know, on Wednesday, the European Space Agency's Gaia mission finally sent back a ton of data. It came with new information about 1.7 billion stars in the Milky Way, including 1.3 billion stars' apparent motion in the sky and actual velocities for over 7 million stars. This is from Gizmodo.com. And one of the possible findings from all of this data, because it's a lot of data, hasn't all been reviewed.
is this how scientists talk? They get in there. They're like, presenting his paper right now is Professor Fillard B. Douchemore. He's like, all right, guys, I got a thesis. And I know you guys are going to be all like, there's no evidence, air quotes, for it.
Oh, I bet you nerds can't wait to peer review everything. Roll the dice.
But one of the possible findings out of this was that our galaxy collided with a gravitational force a few hundred million years ago, relatively recently.
So if it's big enough that we see the effects on our galaxy, you can't just say like, oh, it was an errant black hole or a little chunk of the dark matter passed through us. Like this is a big enough effect that it had to be like another galaxy.
It could possibly be another galaxy. The quote here from Teresa Antoya from the Universitat de Barcelona in Spain says, quote, we have here provided the clearest evidence that our galaxy disk has suffered from perturbations, bringing it to an out of equilibrium state, which may well be due to an interaction with an external satellite galaxy.
So this sounds like a near miss. Your Honor, on behalf of Galaxy M27, I think the evidence will show that the Milky Way galaxy is still, it still has 6 spiral arms, doesn't it? It's still spinning and winning. Who's to say? You're telling me that this was a head-on collision? Point to the damage, Your Honor. Because you're on the trial in this scenario.
Yeah. Gotcha. You know, the set falls apart. Finally, we trapped you. Your Honor, or should I say Steve?
Astronomer Stacy McCaw from the Case Western Reserve University told Gizmodo, quote, this work shows that the stellar disk of the Milky Way is the dynamically active place where spiral arms and the galactic bar leave their marks on the orbits of stars like ripples in a pond. A pond that has perhaps recently felt the splash of a small stone in the form of a merging dwarf galaxy.
So if I'm reading between the lines with my non-scientific brain, it sounds like maybe we were in a near miss and that left ripples in our galaxy that are being detected.
Yeah, that's possible. Or that we could be on a large scale moved because of an effect of like this dwarf galaxy merging that McCaw references here. You know, not necessarily that we hit something, but and maybe a near miss is a good term for it, in that we were close enough that it kind of moved everything a little bit.
So
swayed a little bit.
Whenever we talk about these fundamental questions of the nature of the universe, Justin, it triggers this question of, am I going to live? You know, we all have these fundamental questions, and some of them, many of them have been answered in the last 200, 300 years. You know, dinosaurs, are they real or what?
Sure.
You know, yeah. Carbon dating has unlocked a whole bunch of fundamental questions and so on.
The nature of Jesus Christ. Go ahead.
Correct. although yeah. they did carbon date the Shroud of Turin. Mm. And, that's a whole interesting story. But here's my question.
It was made in 1981.
Actually, yeah, no, it was a hoax made in the Middle Ages, and there's a great program, I forget where, you know, where they show how they did it. But so here's my question to you. I often think, I hope I live long enough for a lot more fundamental questions to be answered.
Okay.
And lately, I'm now wondering, in a world of simulations and VR and of AIs processing data and coming up with some kind of answers that make sense to stuff, I wonder if I just want to live long enough for a really good answer that makes me think. It doesn't even have to be the right answer. Does that make sense? You know, like, I can't wait for the AI simulations of like, okay, this is, given all the data, this is a scenario that actually works, and this is how the many worlds physics model can work and all that stuff. I just want to be like, yeah, that makes sense. But I suppose everybody wanted that forever.
Yeah, I mean, science is a constantly molting beast, right? It's finding new ways that we're wrong over and over again.
Each time, I mean, closer and closer to the real answer.
Yeah.
And also closer and closer to how we can understand the real answer. You know, that's you know, our nature of facts are only as good as we can comprehend. And, you know, history and science have shown that, you know, if you go back even 200 years, the way that we fundamentally understand things are kind of laughable to how we understand them now. So, I've said for the record, I have really no plan on dying. So, like, I do look forward to looking through infinity how we better understand everything.
Either that or oversleeping, quote unquote, oversleeping through the solution.
Yeah. And someone will wake up and people will be like, napping. Oh, here's the nature of the universe. And I'll be like, oh, sweet. Who's got coffee?
Yeah.
Everyone knows this. I missed it. Everyone knows it.
I like this idea of thinking of death as just napping through the rest of history. You're like, oh, man, no, I was having a great time, and I laid down to take a nap. I forgot to wake up. What a bummer, man.
Wait, where are you having this conversation? Yeah,
that's the part I haven't figured out.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
But I can imagine that sure. Upon waking up in a new reality or as a simulation.
Though I think it would probably be, I guess if time travel occurred, if you were able to travel through time, I mean, this is weird, travel forward through time, which we all do constantly,
right?
But if you were to suddenly jump 100 years in the future, you would have a similar feeling of like, well, what's changed? I need to know the fundamental things about life that are so different that I
and of course very comprehend. Very little very little in the last 2,000 years. I mean, there's a reason so many of the lessons of the Bible are relevant today, because life's pretty much the same. you got women's running off with other men's, guys killing other guys.
Uh-huh. I mean, you're always coveting your neighbor's ass.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my goodness. Well, so that's a little bit of a space update. Everybody just make sure, make sure you swap insurance numbers just in case you feel something a week.
Call Saul Starman if you need representation. If you've been injured in an intergalactic collision.
Have you or somebody you know had a dwarf galaxy run into your galaxy? Please call me, Saul Starman.
Oh, Saul Starman, he knows all the stars. Call 1-877 ouch.
Call back to an album we haven't released.
Oh god, that's right.
All right, we have another story here. We've talked a lot about on this show the power of artificial intelligence and quote unquote fake news. It's fake news.
Sure.
I actually, in researching for one of the stories that we're going to talk about a little bit later today, I came across, I don't know if you guys remember, probably within the past year or two, there was this very small announcement sort of thing that more and more places would start using AI and machines to write articles.
Oh, that's right. For example, I know in sports, that a vast majority of auto-updated, up-to-the-minute stuff, they are basically taking the data feed, indicating who scored what point or whatever.
And it just would plugging use, it in.
Yeah, and there's a bank of synonyms, and a robot would say, like, Saul Starman, in a surprise, joining the NFL through a touchdown pass. And, you know, like you don't need to pay a minimum wage copy editor for any of that.
Right. And so I in one of the stories that we'll talk about later, I kept finding a lot of stories that were very clearly like pieced together by a machine. You know, they would bold key things that it thought were keywords, but very much were not keywords, like technology. And it's like, well, yeah, it's a tech story. Well, technology is not the big word. And I think this kind of maybe is a little hand in hand with the idea of fake news or falsified news stories, things that are promoting urban legends or outright lies, things that did not happen. And Facebook is one of the largest, I don't know that you would call them a publisher of news. They're certainly an aggregate when it comes to news reporting. But Facebook has trouble telling people, hey, this link is not real or this is a hoax. You know, there was at some point where The Onion, if you posted a link to The Onion, it would have a thing on Facebook that said this article is satirical because people would just look at the articles and think, oh, my gosh, Obama put his fingers in who's soup?
Yeah.
Oh, man. If we could spend the next 40 minutes just looking at that article again,
on,
I would.
Moving on. I'm shocked that you even went there, Bryce. No, this is a black hole for another 20 minutes.
So Facebook announced at let me get the article. At the Fighting Abuse at Scale event in San Francisco on Friday, that it would be shrinking fake news stories.
Shrinking? Okay.
Shrinking them.
Oh, like making them physically smaller?
It would visibly make them smaller in a report.
Or I guess you could also make them dimmer or mm-hmm. some kind of visual cue that inherently says, trust this less or you'll have to work harder to read it.
I've said this since they started doing this on Daily Tech News Show, that this is a hell portal, hashtag portal to hell, to try to be a referee for what is real and what is fake. And Facebook has found themselves in a very, very tricky position in that they now have all these questions of how they've affected reality since we now have a situation that was supposed to go one way and then went another in the 2016 election. And a lot of people are very upset about it and want to find out why that happened. And part of what sprung out of that was fake news. But we still haven't really, at least Facebook hasn't come out and said, this is what fake news is. Where I think initially the idea was, all right, there were these kids in Macedonia that were creating just random jumbles of headlines. So like Hillary Clinton caught shoplifting, has seizure on way to the police station. And it would be at like USA.patriot.eagle, right? And you would click on it.
USAPatriot.eagle is fake?
And .eagle is my favorite top level domain.
And so the site was literally just there with a bunch of gibberish on it to get the random clicks on links, you know, to generate money. And so those links, I think you can very easily identify, all right, there is not a shred of truth in any of this. But even then, you now move on to the more sophisticated version where you're just writing outrageous opinions. Yeah. And that is where I think when you are deciding to play the referee, you now get to the question of, all right, well, if people want to read this, should we play referee against it or how do we label it? And when the line is this truth or not, then boy, You are entering into a long, 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 complicated conversation that nobody's here for a nuanced version of because it's Facebook and everyone just wants to yell at their aunt.
So two things. Number one, hearing about the auto-generated nonsense articles, I posted this, I forgot somewhere.
I think on Twitter?
Yeah.
Or no, it was in Slack.
It was in Slack. Internally, your and my name showed up because I have a Google News alert. And when something pops up in the news, it shows up. This is a totally legitimate article in the Crime Scene Journal discussion group with with the headline, Take Pleasure in the Garden, Explicit, by Brian Brushwood and Justin Robert Young on Amazon Music.
Now, this is in the cold cases section, of course, published April 17 by Zachariah Senshore 10.
An outstanding Elizabethan household with acclaimed gardens, three traditional, like, we're not mentioned again in the entire computer-generated article.
Well, and that's not even the name, right? Like, I know. It's like slightly different.
It's a mistranslation or an intentional reworking of it, of Enjoy the Garden.
Well, and that's so the sort of thing where, you know, this article that I referenced earlier, that might have been, and I don't know that was trying to, like, push, you know, this service, really, this thing, but it also could have just been an SEO thing, which is a very common thing, to make fake blogs that all link around to each other so that Google knows that all of these blogs have links and influence and are correct, quote unquote, to boost SEO. So
I can make sure that these guys get a good talking to, what's their phone number again?
Google?
No, the SEO companies that will, because I'm gonna really let them have it.
I believe it's 1-800 literally any country on earth that I don't want to mention, that might be offensive. But it's a weird thing. Here's how the Facebook system works, is that it will use machine learning algorithms to scan an article when someone posts a link to an article for signs of false information. If it senses that a story may be fake, the system sends it to a third-party fact checker to look into the validity of the article.
So here's the important part. Mm-hmm. I think Facebook – I suspect Facebook is making a mistake by making themselves the arbiter of what is and is not true. I would rather see a version where you subscribe to PolitiFact or whatever, like a trust, like I trust these guys, they do their homework or whatever. The problem with that is how long do we get until the fractal resets itself and it's like, oh, well, I'm subscribed to crazy red state hijacker news and they tell me all of your info is fake and like other guys tell me your info is fake.
You want to know what though? That's fine. Because we're like that anyway. Like that's just us getting back to zero and not, you know, having Facebook be looked at as super damaging. Because you can just say, hey, look, here are our available filters. And we are going to maybe make some, you know, even I think you're right. Like have it be something that you could buy. Like, hey, a $3 filter that supports PolitiFact or supports, you know, the question then becomes, all right, so when InfoWars says we're making our filters that basically says all of these George Soros run mainstream media outlets are untrustworthy, then do you sell that or do you allow them to do that? Because my argument would be sure, like let people filter things the way that they want because they're already getting filtered. I mean, like this is already happening. You're already creating these echo chambers, and at the very least you can say consensus. This is the filter that people enjoy the most,
you know,
or
you're
find
right.
or have downloaded.
But
the
I worry about it less when I think about it as a stepping stone to some kind of consensus, or at least having some kind of easy way for you know, like if a friend posts something that, let's say you're subscribed to, dang, I don't know, it gets so nasty and gnarled.
But is there a reason Facebook shouldn't do this? I mean,
well,
Facebook is the platform holder. They ostensibly don't want to send this out to some other party to determine this filtering stuff.
No. I think you can do it internally. Right now, they've partnered with like Snopes and PolitiFact to initially, in one of the many attempts to skin the cat that they've done with this, one of them was to go to trusted and reputable sources to officially through Facebook label something as disputed, right?
See, and I think I would like it I think they can get away with this if, you know, you mouse over something and all of a sudden a pop-up gives you like seven different major sites recognizable. Snopes says 83% accurate. PolitiFact says, you know, 74% accurate, or you know, maybe has individual comments on there.
Because my feeling with I think the idea of having individual filters and some sort of web injection whatever product is a fine idea and is a good democratization of the information. But there are so many people who are just into the Facebook ecosystem, especially outside of the U.S.
That as a first step, like literally anybody step in and do this. Then right. Let's get mad that they're biased and then fraction off into individual, you know, providers.
Because there's a if you make the barrier to get into this too high, the needle won't move for a huge swath of people. You know, they're either they can't afford a filter, they don't have the right browser and hardware, this, that, or the other thing. But it's at least as something that is trying to be, hey, we're doing this and we're trying to do it for everyone so you don't have to think about it. I at least understand it from an ease of use standpoint.
Yeah.
By the way, Tom Merritt of Daily Tech News Show points out that initial list was, and I don't have it in front of me anymore.
ABC News, The Associated Press, FactCheck.org, mm-hmm. PolitiFact, and Snopes, and the Weekly Standard.
And one article that I saw was also UrbanLegend.com or something like that, an Urban Legend website.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the actual list or suggestions, but either way, I know
that. I'm pretty sure that was the list that initially the Facebook. Used to determine whether things were disputed or not.
I'm okay with that because I could see you could make a case that one's more tilted one way or the other, but I think that's a good list right there.
Well, and this is all I think solving this is a very important issue because of the second story that we have here. This was published March 8th in Gizmodo. There's a large study that attempted to understand the virality of real and fake information. And the very short, condensed version is that, quote, just know the overall study found that false stories spread farther, faster, deeper, and more broadly than true stories.
Make a stab at, without even reading the article,
sure.
Make a hypothesis about it, and you can tell me if it seems to resonate with it? This is in advertising. People have a tendency, they talk about benefits versus features. The feature is that it has a reclining headrest on this truck. Mm-hmm. The feature is that you can go into your day better rested with a more comfortable ride. And factually, they're identical, but one is more feeling-based or whatever. And I think fake news caters to the feeling side of things. In advertising circles, it's like, don't make the mistake of saying features when what you want to express is the benefit to the consumer, whereas fake news is pure benefit to the consumer. You want to feel right? Click this. Ooh, yeah. Doesn't that feel good? Doesn't matter if it's true or not. Felt good. Whereas, authentic, well-vetted media is features and not benefits.
Yes, and I think we're increasingly seeing that traditional media leans more toward confirmation bias than it really ever has. And not to say that the reporting is wrong or bad, it is just that's where the money is, you know, and on some levels it kind of always has been. But if anything, we're getting into a very weird, although I would say hopefully when we're on the other end of this wormhole, we will say that it is healthy situation where media is so democratized and people are scrambling so hard to find out where the life rafts are that hopefully we will develop better habits coming out of it. But right now we're just in a very awkward adolescence where everything is based on, do you feel good after reading this? And to say fake news, that fake news spreads further is kind of weird because to me, salacious news spreads the furthest because we are pattern recognizing creatures and anything headline, pattern continues. Cool. My brain has already assumed that pattern continues. Headline, pattern shattered. New pattern emerges. Immediately we need to go find the information on that. And so whether it's a misleading headline whether it's a reporter deliberately falling into a narrative that is being laid out by a source or multiple sources, like this is what creates our confirmation biases without us necessarily having to be like, meh, like mustache twirling, like I'll shape all their opinions to my will. It's not that. It's very understandable. And ultimately, that's why it drives clicks, because we want to always want to read about the unpredictable, and more so we want to read about the unpredictable that confirms that we were right when we were suspecting that it was going to be unpredictable.
So two things in this study that I mentioned, they analyzed user comments on various news articles, both what they're called false stories and true stories, and found that false stories inspire fear, disgust, and surprise, while true stories inspired anticipation, sadness, joy, and trust. Above all, surprise was the biggest reaction to false news, which led one of the researchers to believe that fake news has more to do with human nature and its attraction to novelty than anything else.
That sounds consistent with everything we've said so far, right?
Yeah.
Yep. I think, Justin, you tapped into something. It really is a fundamental primal, I guess a primate instinct. We're attracted to gossip because gossip was fundamentally important for survival. You know, if you're familiar with Dunbar's number, the idea that our brains are evolved to about process 150 tribe members, everyone else is the other. That's the reason if I mention, you know, Mongolia, you think of one person to represent that entire country because you can't handle the overwhelming thought of so many different people. But in that 150 tribe of humanity, it's very important to know if person who is a member of your tribe is cheating on other person's monkey or whatever. And so likewise, I think that's the fundamental.
Paws off my monkey.
Well, because that lets you know whether or not you can transact with that ape or trust him to be a good faith negotiator in the future.
Yeah,
sure. Look, I got into journalism because I liked gossip, because I liked being the first person to tell somebody something. That's what journalism is. To me, at its very, very core, is understanding your reality and processing it and having a zeal to let other people know. And then from that zeal, from that primal kind of like, oh, I need to know who's dating who or what they said about X, you learn that the best way to do it is by these kind of journalistic principles of finding out and corroborating facts and figuring out how to write it or say it. But at the end of the day, look, we just want to know, all of us universally want to know what our reality is and how we can best operate within it. Mm-hmm. And that is dependent on us not knowing what's real, but knowing what is unreal, or where we are mistaken so we can correct. Because we all kind of assume that if we are led down a path that we know everything, then we are going to be caught unaware, and we are going to be, in some way affected detrimentally. And that's why, again, it is the pattern breakers that are the most salacious.
And on top of all of this, this is a University of Michigan study that found out that people who believed, who they said had a belief superiority personality, who believed that their viewpoints were superior, tend to be less informed than those who self-identify as someone who is more humble. So
that's also true, if I'm remembering correctly, in studies where people are made artificial mayors of fictitious towns and they're psychologically evaluated beforehand, whether if they have a core set of beliefs and they go in with predispositions, they tend to mismanage the town and it spirals out of control. Whereas those who come in were like, okay, I'm just going to really look at all the data, I'm going to make small moves and see the effects and just respond to whatever it is, because my goal is to get these town imaginary numbers really high. And so those who come in, you know, with a framework that they believe is right tend to do poorly.
Yeah, a couple of findings from the study. Belief superior people were significantly more likely than their modest peers to choose information that supported their beliefs. Furthermore, they were aware that they were seeking out biased information. When researchers asked them what type of articles they had chosen, they readily admitted their bias for articles that supported their own beliefs. So this is all one very big pile. This is a very tough sort of problem, but I think it's worthy to find a solution for.
Yeah, well, and this does sound like a step in the Facebook thing sounds like a step in some kind of right direction or righter direction than where we are right now.
Yeah.
I would say Facebook is taking a lot of stabs in the dark. And unfortunately, I think the problem is that we are looking for Facebook to solve this problem when I don't think it's necessarily in their capability to do it. And I don't know if they're really looking at it in any other way than our face is on fire and we're desperately looking for something to put it out. Like, that's all they care about is real to stop talking about fake news. And so I don't really think that they're trying to solve it. I think that they're trying to get people to stop yelling at them and that they are doing whatever they need to do.
They're not trying to cure the cancer. They're trying to mitigate it and be like, would you just get back to the money factory rolling?
Or literally they're just saying, stop telling us we have cancer and stop telling us that we're giving you cancer because you're on our platform. Like, literally whatever we can do to stop this argument, which is why ultimately here's why I know that this is a PR based thing. If this were just an algorithm thing, Facebook wouldn't be talking about it. They would just be doing it. Facebook does a million different things to make your experience better and richer based on the data that they get of your experience. And they have pioneered a lot of stuff because of it.
Yeah.
They don't talk about – they don't put out a press release because they figured out how to do autoplay videos in a way that wouldn't ruin your browser and wouldn't make your app run like a pile of poop.
Right? Because they're muted and, you know, that was an internal decision that they A/B tested and came out one way or the other. You're right. This is totally political. This is look at us doing the thing that you seem to indicate you would like us to say we're doing.
Yeah.
Also, I might be wrong and they may have put out a press release on the autoplay, but like my point is that these things resonate on a level because they know they are going to resonate on a level, and they know that the hot light is on them because when Zuckerberg goes and, you know, sits on his butt donut in front of Congress and has to eat a pile of poop from every senator and congressman, this is the kind of stuff that he needs to talk about because it's what people care about. And every second that it's talked about, Facebook hates it. It is bringing people a lesser idea of that being on this platform is good for me. And it is making advertisers more nervous about, well, I don't know, should we put more? Should we increase our Facebook budget by 10% or 50%? Well, let's hedge our bets a little bit, you know, going into it. And that's all that they care about is literally just be on our platform so we can have the widest available demographic map so we can sell the best ads. And where I think we need to solve this is a more fundamental thing, and that's what I think that we're just in an awkward adolescence on, of what is journalism? How do we feed information to each other at a point where the newspapers are all newsrooms and every blog has the ability to be the best newsroom in the world? Who do we reward? Who do we punish? How do we look at these things as valuable to us? And it's why I've always, as somebody who came from journalism, hate the like stories of the mythic, you know, warrior Christ called journalists who sort fact from fiction to
the
us.
The Fourth Estate, our most important United States resource.
Exactly. It's like, look, I'm always going to cape up for journalists. I love it. It's half my friends are journalists, but they're humans. And we need to, like, specifically in a world now where everything is trackable and we have facts for everything, which means everything is both simultaneously true and untrue because you can distort facts to create any reality that you want. We need to understand kind of fundamentally what truth and the gathering of it is. And we are in the process of doing it. And I don't know when we'll be on the other side, but I know it's not now.
Yeah.
Well, you know what you don't need to be on the other side of is patreon.com/weirdthing. Support the show.
Yeah, why, man, don't you? Listen, I know that you've been thinking about it, but what do you say you just go on, get on in the hot tub we call Patreon?
Yeah, give us a dollar an episode. I'm sure you're getting so much out of these episodes and you just want to give us back. You just want to give us a dollar.
Yeah, it's called value for value. People, you go to the store, you don't say, well, let me try drinking all this milk, and then maybe I'll maybe I'll just tell a friend. Isn't that great? I'll talk about how great the milk is that I drank from your store. Meanwhile, that cow put out that milk, and that farmer squeezed them cow nipples, and the bottler bottled it, and the driver drove it, and the seller sold it. What are you doing? Head on over to patreon.com/weirdboys.
I'll tell you what, if that metaphor did make sense, then give us $2.
Give us $2. You can get early access to our sister show After Things, which is all about being a creative professional. And you make sure that this show happens every week. You know, this week, Andrew sat down yesterday to go see Avengers Infinity War. And because that movie is so goddamn long, he won't be back until next week.
He's still there watching it. Yeah.
Still watching it.
We should be getting Andrew back.
I think next week.
Soon. Yeah, next week?
I believe May 5th is the word that I heard. So
right. He is he's close to being finished with the things that he's
almost done being dead, battling demons in hell.
Yeah.
He's about to emerge victorious on the other side, bloodied and emboldened.
If you have been listening to these episodes and you're like, God, another week without Andrew, don't worry. Everything that he's done will be very, very excited.
Yeah.
Exciting when we can reveal it.
Yeah. I love the mixing of ideas. The idea that he's also working on something and that he's still watching the very long Marvel
movie. He's doing
all
those. Look, it's a very important vacation-related project that involves him dying, going to hell, battling hell demons.
That's right.
And emerging victorious. He's almost done.
Absolutely.
And Android Main will be back, or his replacement.
That's right.
So head on over there, patreon.com/weirdthings.
That's right.
Kick us a little coin, you cheapo.
Gentlemen, I have a couple of shorter segments here. Y'all see the tweet? Did you guys see the tweet?
Which tweet? Is that a new TV show where they just...
On Wednesday, April 25th.
April 25th. The tweet.
The tweet.
Do you remember where you were when you read the tweet?
Yeah. Do you remember where you were when you read that John F. Kennedy was assassinated on Twitter?
In a tweet.
11/22/18. No, of course, I'm talking about our favorite futurist and high-tech trillionaire, probably. Oh. Elon Musk.
Never heard of him.
April 25th, is this the tweet?
It's Elon Musk, man. He's always getting into something. I did see this tweet. If this is what, I can't imagine that it would be anything else, but that dude always up to something, and this time, you know what, Brian? He might have done did it for the last time. Do you see what he's up to now?
No. It can't be worse than selling flamethrowers.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. Funny you should say flamethrower. Because he's inventing a robot dragon.
He says, oh, BTW, I'm building a cyborg dragon.
Okay.
I love that the first response.
About effing time.
what do you think the cyborg dragon is?
Can I tell you? There is a series of books. There's an author named Pierce Anthony.
Milan Osk.
Who did a... series of books called the Incarnations of Immortality series, where the first book, somebody kills death and has to become death, and then the rest are about time, fate, and all this stuff. I loved his books. I got really into them, and I ended up following the rabbit hole down to, as a kid, reading his Adept series of books, which was two worlds. One had magic. One was science. Proton and Phase, they were called.
Okay.
Those are clever names. And there was a shimmering curtain between them. And a few people figured out they could go from one world to the other, right? And once they knew the two worlds were there, the science world attempted to approximate aspects of the fantasy world.
Okay.
And so, for example, there are no dragons in science world, but they could build simulacrum of them that were very believable, that that you could ride around, that were, in fact, like dog brains and brain stems and nervous systems hooked up to dragon mechanical bodies.
Okay.
So if I could totally see him taking a dog, amplifying everything about the dog's like in a body armor suit or whatever.
Sure.
Stuff's like, you know, permanently attached to, or maybe a rabbit. Rabbits would be too scared. You don't want a scared dragon.
No.
Who's the chill? A sloth dragon?
Sloths are dangerous, though. Sloths are slow, but they're dangerous.
What's the most chill animal that you would want to hook up to a giant, powerful, robotic dragon-like body.
I mean, a golden retriever.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a golden retriever, and he's got implants and everything. So the golden retriever, as far as he knows, he's just walking around in his, you know, he grows up in a robot dragon body. But meanwhile, okay. it's a golden retriever on the inside,
yeah,
and a dragon body on the outside. That's what I think.
Okay, so that's Brian's guess. A dog put into a mechanical dragon.
No, you'd need a bird. It had to be like a parrot's brain or something.
Jeez.
Like
right? Why? Because you want the dragon to go constantly and then constantly be petty and judging you? And isn't that what dragons do?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, no. The quiet as a church mouse dog idea is really going to go
not
go
just
way
dog,
better.
Golden retriever. Golden retriever. It's an important distinction.
Yeah, that dragon's going to hold eggs in its mouth and it's not going to break them, Justin. Yeah,
also, it's going to be constantly seeking your approval.
No, what do you
say? Because by the way, a hallmark of the dogs that you've raised has not exactly been silent.
Hey, man, listen to what I say, not what I do. I like Sunbun's idea of a cyborg corgi, though. All right, make the case for
cyborgy.
Cyborgy. I think you're right, though, Justin. If you wanted to take an animal that was already the most dragon-like and give it the body of a dragon, I do think a bird would be correct.
Yeah, I mean, because you're looking at a version of a dinosaur, right? Like a fantasized version of a dinosaur. So, I mean, but even then, it's like I actually wonder how hard it would be to approximate like an AI version of like a parrot's brain.
I bet it's one of those projects that sounds really simple, and then suddenly you discover it's really, really difficult. Like, what was the guy? Rodney
Dangerfield.
No. if you type in AI,
I'm trying to make an AI parrot.
Hey, the guy from MIT that made the bug robots,
Rodney Brooks.
That's right. So back in the late '90s or mid '90s, early '90s, he was like, "Look, let's stop trying to make humans. Humans are really complicated. Let's see if we can just copy a bug. Let's give a simple set of instructions that would mimic a cockroach. Let's conquer that and then climb up from there." It turns out, like already, it's like they could get halfway there very quickly, and then they discover there's a lot more nuance than you would expect in
a bug's brain.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess the question would be not making a perfect version, but making something that could approximate
a dragon.
You know, to the outside. The outside person, what it would be like. Like, you wouldn't be able to make a roach that would actually do roach things.
But
right?
you could make a
roach that looked like what a roach looks like to us, in that it just skittered around and then hid in the walls for a while, right?
Right, right.
And so I would wonder if you were to do something to make, like, a cyborg dragon, like, what the level... I guess, like, what part is the organic matter, or what part is the robot.
You've seen the homegrown cyborg cockroach kits, right? Have you seen this?
No.
So you...
Oh, that's where you like attach like a chip to a dead cockroach and it comes back to life?
No. So what it is, you take a live cockroach, and the instructions are take a live cockroach. And this is the thing, is that it requires you to do actual surgery on the cockroach, which makes some people feel oogie. So it never busted out and went really mainstream. In fact, we talked about doing this on the Modern Rogue, but we never got around to it because we're like, the negative feedback would be insane. Although meanwhile, like, nobody has a problem with spraying genocidal poisons on them or squishing them or whatever.
Okay.
But the idea of using it for science upsets some people. But you take a cockroach and you put it in ice water, and after about 5 minutes, it will kind of seize up, basically. It's anesthetized, or it can't move.
Right.
And so you have about 5 minutes where you cut open part of the carapace and you inject one electrode into squishy part A, another electrode on squishy part B, and you attach a couple wires to its antenna. And then basically between the conduction of electricity on one side or the other, you now have a remote controlled cockroach, to where you can click a button and it will send a low voltage current that makes the cockroach think this is a wall over here. So it turns left to get away from the wall, and then feels like, nope, the wall's over there, and then turns to the right.
So all we got to do is just kill a dragon, or no, capture a dragon live and attach electrodes to its antenna.
again, this goes back to like, what's the question of like, what's the original source material? I guess a Komodo dragon is a dragon.
We talked a few years ago, and I think this was like Andrew's analysis, that he believed the idea of dragons were built, were from Europe, because and there had been a migration of alligators or crocodiles, one of those that is not native to that area, and they just called it a dragon.
Yeah.
And they believe, you know, over time, build it up.
And that's why, like he says, building a cyborg dragon, he would be factually accurate if they were making any kind of enhancements to a Komodo dragon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, no, totally. I think that's likely. Like, at some point, we're just going to see some research paper, and he's going to be, like, a dude who was involved in it.
So you guys are both in the robotic dragon or partially organic dragon theory.
Yeah, or yeah, I don't know, or crazy laser targeting eye attached to a Komodo dragon. I mean, you just glue that on there. Technically, that's a cyborg dragon if he uses it and likes it.
Okay. Danny Paez at inverse.com has his own theory, which is that you guys know that there is a product that Elon Musk makes called the Dragon.
Oh my God. He's talking about putting a living brain inside of a dragon capsule.
Yeah, I'm going to quote from inverse.com. It seems likely that SpaceX's Dragon capsule is about to become powered by artificial intelligence, and it might offer a human brain interface via Neuralink, another Elon Musk venture. If a Dragon crew capsule, one in which astronauts would fly, were developed to incorporate a neural lace component, Musk might just bring astronauts with internet-powered superintelligence to space.
So
this is all a theory.
That seems like that would make a lot more sense.
So there was, I want to say, in World War II, an experiment for a guided missile that involved training pigeons to keep a certain target inside of a square, and they would peck left, peck right, and then they would be rewarded with treats for keeping the whatever the target is inside of this target zone. Mm-hmm. And then they would put the pigeon inside the missile and it would peck left, peck right up until, instead of a reward, it blew up.
It died.
And it makes me wonder if some kind of like biological interface could be possible with the Dragon capsule, that like really you could, if you stuck a pigeon and said, you know, we're using pigeon run targeting for visual whatever,
yeah,
then technically that would be a cyborg dragon, right?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the idea is trying to rethink from 2018 forward, what is manned space travel? Considering where we are now. And it seems very much like Elon Musk to just say, all right, well, I'm already researching all this neural lace stuff. It would be better if you could just plug in to this larger interface. And so therefore a captain or a crew member of a space capsule could know far more, A, about the craft, and B, about where they're going. And maybe that would also help with the idea of the longer trips, like, let's say to Mars, of like, you know, I don't know, would you be able to get bored if you could, you know, have all of the world's knowledge in your head, you know, at any single moment? Like,
well, and I think that's one of the smart things about the plan. This is a bit of a diversion, but I think that's one of the smartest thing about the plan that Elon unveiled to go to Mars, because it involved other people. You won't get bored, but you could get very, very lonely, right? And so if you have if you make it a party of 150 people, also Dunbar's number, probably not coincidental. Then all of a sudden you have a tribe and a village and a vibrant community that matches the amount of people that your primate brain wants to be surrounded by.
Hmm. Very cool. We got another. So since we're talking about space, you probably did see this over the weekend. Blue Origin successfully tested their new Shepard reusable launch system.
Yeah, I have not seen this. We're looking at it. Boy, I love all of the live streaming, well-produced stuff. I love that they're making it so easy, all these companies, mm-hmm. to follow along and understand the technology behind stuff and know what to look for in each of these tests.
Yeah.
It looks good.
So this was a test of their reusable launch system and a little bit of their capsule system. The capsule landed successfully after detaching from the top of the rocket and deploying its parachutes. All in all, this was the eighth flight of the new Shepard system since its launch in 2015 and the second test of the newly redesigned rocket and capsule.
And forgive me if Andrew was here, I bet he would be able to recall it instantly, but is the new Shepard able to do single stage to orbit, or it just gets really high?
I believe this is a capsule slash space tourism shaped test.
Yeah.
Because it goes up to about the Kármán line, but I don't know that it crosses it.
So this is just you're technically in space, not quite. I guess that's why they call it Shepard, because mm-hmm. Alan Shepard was not the first to orbit. John Glenn was the first to orbit, but Alan Shepard was the first American in space.
Right. So the capsule, after ascending for 2 minutes, the capsule, which can carry 6 people at a time, detaches from the rocket as it reaches the edge of outer space, at which point passengers experience weightlessness. They're also able to see the curvature of the Earth through very large windows.
Dude, that is so dope. I mean, like, it is just so amazing, and it's almost even cooler that this isn't just a SpaceX technology, that, like, we are just watching the new normal be reusable rockets when, I mean, man, like, this was, like, at the point that we were doing, that we began this podcast, it was thought to be implausible, if not impossible, right? Like,
yeah.
And now it's like, this is just you are an idiot if you're building a rocket and not making it reusable.
Well,
like, it is something that you are being clowned for.
I think you nailed it. The remarkable part to me is less that we have reusability, although that is very, very remarkable, but it is an understated second level of amazement that I get from realizing that there are competing designs that are functional. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. this is what, not that we have to standardize on one or the other, but, you know, which flavor of reusable rocket do you want your satellite or your body to go up in?
Well, I kind of like that they're aiming at different things. Like, this is a capsule launch and reusability test system where SpaceX is about going to orbit and breaking out of orbit.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, look, I think the general concept is a robust ecosystem of a lot of different players trying to make this a reality means that the technology will continue to advance at the pace that it has, which has brought us possibilities that we had not really even counted on 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. The fact that, I mean, Blue Origin is just kind of, you know, look, they're newer to the game, not to say in terms of the length of when these companies have been around, but certainly in terms of what they've done. And SpaceX is continuing to ramp up based on the idea that they are a huge provider for how to get into space right now, in a way that Blue Origin has the ability, considering its patronage, to sort of take exactly their time before they needed to start making money. I mean, SpaceX, look, again, SpaceX was about to go out of business if they weren't able to start making money on their product.
Blue Origin, I think, can afford to
fart around for as long as they want until they get exactly what they want.
Although, I mean, I guess there's nobody really nipping at their heels behind them. I mean, maybe ULA is working on some kind of reusable launch stuff.
You'd have to imagine. I mean, obviously, like, there's only so much that they can talk about when they already have contracts for other rockets that they are calling the top of the line. But you'd have to be shocked if they're not on some level working on something in the idea that maybe, you know, the SLS or something isn't going to be funded, that maybe they have plan B.
Yeah.
Yeah. In tangential Elon Musk news, Elon Musk, you know, not directly related to this, came out today. Yeah, today, that Hyperloop One, this is the Virgin version of Hyperloop, is teaming up with DP World to make a cargo-only shipping business, which will probably start in the Middle East. Richard Branson even said in an interview with MSNBC that they may drop the Hyperloop branding because he believes his company has progressed much further than any other Hyperloop-branded company.
Is Hyperloop like an open source thing that they're working together?
Yeah, Elon Musk has a Hyperloop project of his own, but I believe he open sourced this technology. And it's basically, if you don't know, it's like, if you know what a maglev train is, it is a train that runs on a magnetic track, but there's also an element where the tube is partially vacuumized of oxygen so right. that they can reach up to, I believe it's 300 meters a second?
In other words, like when you think about a train levitating on magnets rushing forward, the limitation is that it starts, you know, running headlong into headwinds and it's just, you know, it's like plowing through molasses. And so the idea is, well, let's make a giant straw to remove the molasses, and with less air, there'll be less air resistance, and we could just zippity-doo-dah super fast down.
Yeah, they said that in the press release for this, that this would bring the price of trucking materials across the world, but with the convenience and speed of flight, of flying cargo around.
Wow.
So it's interesting. It is good to see that this technology is being used for a very specific business purpose.
I'm still very bearish on this ever being practical in America. Yeah. I think we'll fly stuff around with drones, but I do understand in the Middle East or whatever, where you have giant chunks of desert and there's no easements or right-of-ways or eminent domain concerns or any of that, then yeah, by all means, just build a giant straw and shoot stuff from one side to the other.
There's a few places in the Middle East where you don't exactly have to worry about citizen lawsuits or a mayor not being reelected because you took away the one thing that the locals like. There's some top-down authority in the Middle East that can allow for these projects to move a little faster. I'm very curious, though. I think that the one thing I will say about this over drone delivery, and I think that they are trying to do things differently. They're saying that these Maersk size cargo shipping containers that come off ships can then unload right into these tubes and go out to distribution hubs. Whereas I think drone delivery, I don't think you're looking at taking the entire payload of a Maersk container and then flying that somewhere. Mm-hmm. But at least it would be theoretically unobtrusive if it's underground in a way that you will always either be able to see or hear a drone.
Yeah. I kind of am of two minds, because I think you made a very good point in that there are parts of the world where creating large, whether they're above ground or below ground, tracks is incredibly beneficial. But it reminds me a lot of just like pneumatic tubes. I'm sure that there are permanent pathways that are very helpful, but it becomes very permanent. But on the other hand, it's exactly like a train or any number of light rail or our existing maglev trains. So I'm kind of on both sides about this.
Both sides in terms of being for it or again it, or
or just whether
or betting on it versus betting against.
More betting on it versus against.
I think it will find, like many other things, a very specialized use that it will be very, very helpful. But I think, unfortunately, they're selling it on the vision of transforming reality and your everyday commute or whatever. And I just don't see that happening any more than the Segway transformed how urban communities were planned.
I mean, I don't know. I think there's a reason why Elon Musk has open sourced the Hyperloop technology and put his own money in the tunneling technology, because and not to say that he has to put his money behind Hyperloop, but obviously the Boring Company is something that he has taken more and more seriously, because I think that's the point in which you can go to a city hall and say, hey, can we tunnel under downtown? And they can say yes or no.
They're like, a number of people bothering me if you do that. Mole men don't count, so yes. And whereas can I go through five different business districts and carve up a bunch of stuff, cause a bunch of traffic problems, all that stuff.
Yeah, because even the initial Hyperloop idea of, all right, well, we're going to put an elevated train on Route 5 going, up and down California, you're still dealing with a million kinds of problems that will probably never be resolved.
Yeah. Well, and so I was thinking about kind of the permanence of a Hyperloop station. And it reminded me of this video that I had seen a few years ago, and I want to share it with you. I don't know if you guys have ever seen it. I don't think it's a well-known thing. But have you ever heard of this company, Dahir InShot?
No, but I'm no. Yeah, show me.
So this is a Russian something firm. I don't exactly know what they do. They come up with these pre-viz sort of videos demonstrating ideas and concepts. And the Hyperloop got me thinking about this video that they made for their idea of an automated restaurant.
Dahir Inshad would like to present instant service technology for large-scale dining establishments. The essence of this invention lies in the automation of the processes of cooking and serving meals, which makes it possible to reduce customer wait time to just a few minutes.
All right, so far we're seeing a bunch of clip art, prepackaged, what looks like breaking Fox News alert news sure, intro yeah. packages.
Yeah.
And we're seeing a virtual representation of basically it looks like a ballroom at a hotel with a bunch of people sitting in.
Yeah, kind of looks like something you'd see in like Disney World, like one of the little like cafeteria places where there's like nothing but expansive seating.
Yeah, okay.
Let's take a closer look at this technology. The server takes an order from a group of customers and, using a tablet computer, sends a request to the kitchen, where the meals are prepared.
Okay, so far we have a human being uses an iPad, which I'm questioning why the human being even needs to be there, because I just went through the United Terminal in Newark, and they already got this on rails, where they go straight to the iPad. You just punch in the food you want.
Tablet computer sends a request to the kitchen, where the meals are prepared.
Okay.
Above the dining area is a space in which meals are transferred from the kitchen to customers' tables using conveyor belts and mechanical arms. The orders are distributed using a system.
So can you describe this?
Okay, so imagine. Okay, so what they're saying is keep the human who walks up and says, "Tell me the food you want to have," but eliminate the other human that just walks over and hands you the food, and instead replace it with a giant, rigid, inflexible set of conveyor belts that can send pods of food one at a time to various tables.
The dish reaches its final destination, a compartment located about the customer's table. An automated mechanical arm takes it and brings it down into the dining area.
This is okay.
The automation
this
of the
is so much
of
more expensive than minimum wage. Like,
so
this
quickly.
Is insane.
Can you describe the mechanism?
So basically, all of this is. I thought we were going to get like some sort of kitchen technology where it's like, all right, like you can understand that pre-work takes this amount of time, washing vegetables, chopping vegetables, creating simple stews that you're going to use in multiple dishes. Here's an automated way that we can like take out all that work and you can reduce kitchen staff. But instead, this is all about, like what Brian pointed out, fixing literally the most replaceable thing, which is food running. They created a gigantic, like a totally super expensive system that involves a gigantic venue where you can only put the ceiling light comes down and brings your food.
Yeah, basically
it's a big metal arm that comes in from the
that
roof.
Comes out of the ceiling, right? And then deposits your food on there. The infrastructure costs are insane looking.
Not only that,
customers leave the table.
You still have to bust the table.
The server collects the used dishes and places them in a special container that is then sent to the lower floor, where an automated high-pressure dishwasher is located. This technology makes it possible to.
By the way, yeah, because for whatever reason, you definitely need somebody else to do it. Like you can't even rely on the stupid customers to put the thing in the other thing.
It's just. It's great, and they the sizes of the restaurants that they're showing off are gigantic.
Well, and I don't think they mean it to be a restaurant. I think this is for banquets. If you have a banquet facility, and you think somehow that maybe if you're catering to people who don't like the ethnicity of the country of the convention that they're at, and you want to avoid them seeing any human beings, then, right? Then
finally,
this makes sense.
A restaurant solution for visiting races.
I mean, that's what it feels like to me, right?
So they've got a bunch of B-roll here. But this is huge.
It's
hundreds
massive.
Of tables.
And this is, I can't imagine. Even banquets, like even like the size of an average banquet hall where you're going to be serving everybody a meal, like I can't even imagine what this would be for.
Well, and the other thing is like even if the banquet hall, you can't move the tables
yeah,
around.
Yeah, exactly. You can't. There's no flexibility with this. It's like let's install a completely rigid structure that is not ideal for very many different things.
Wow.
It's just. Wow. Also, yeah, not only does it not save time, because all it's doing is eliminating the person handing you your food.
Right.
It's not speeding up the thing that takes the longest, which is cooking the food.
Right. Well, and it's reducing, I would say, a lot, flexibility, which is also a very important thing when you're hosting various events.
Because there's a ton of footage of, like, what these restaurants look like. And because you can't move tables around, they have to have, like, a million different types of tables. Huge tables for big parties, small tables. Some of these have booths somehow.
All right. This is ridiculous.
This is crazy.
Get this out of here.
There are a lot more of these videos that maybe we'll look at in the future.
Does this company, like, exist?
This is a real company.
It's a YouTube channel, but are they a company?
Oh, yeah. Yes. That's a very long story that we can get into another time.
Okay.
But if you Google Dahir in chat, you'll find lots of their videos as well as some very good commentated sort of breakdowns.
Like the solar roadways breakdowns
that
people were doing.
just thinking of, like, Hyperloop and the very specific point-to-point delivery sort of reminded me of this very dumb idea. Anyway. That's all I've got for you guys this week for weird things. You guys have picks?
That's all you got. All you got all is an hour and change of amazing stories.
Yeah, all you do is just making great content. Hashtag premium content.
Hey, Justin.
Yeah.
Is your pick my pick?
I don't think so, but I do know if what you think is your pick is my pick, then I think that I very much enjoyed your pick.
Yeah.
Infinity War.
I mean, Is that going to end up being all of After Things? Are we just going to talk Infinity War? Or are we going to?
I think we have an email, but I'm sure at some point we'll wind up chopping up.
So let's save it for when Andrew's here, because I'm sure Andrew will want to talk.
I agree. Suffice to say, I rather enjoyed Infinity War, but if I'm going to pick something else, I'm going to give a shout out to season 3 of The Expanse. It's very, very good. Still a very good show, and it's now got an in depth enough story that. I'm forgetting parts of season 1 and season 2, which has me excited to go back to rewatch all those, because I know they put a lot of effort into making everything consistent in a believable near future sci-fi story that takes place in our solar system.
And it's based off a book series, right? So, like, I think Tom has a better idea because he's read these books. But, like, the first season is about the first book, or the first half of the first book, or something like that?
Yeah. Well, and the second, in fact, the end of the first book occurs halfway through season 2, which is very unusual. It felt very much like a season finale, but you're only halfway through the season, which I think is a smart move because it gives you time. You're still rolling through the season to cue up the story that engages in season 3.
Yeah. Very cool. The Expanse. That's sci-fi, right?
Sci-fi channel. S-Y-F-Y.
Justin, you got a pick?
I want to real quick just make my pick a shout out to something that I first saw actually on Bryce's Twitter today, and that was a video by Simone Gertz. You probably know her as the shitty robot lady. She makes hilariously ridiculous robots that do.
She'll build a robot to apply lipstick and then submit herself to this robot smashing red all over her face.
She just did a hilarious video for Westworld where she made a hilariously crappy video or a robot that was supposed to be her and then, like, you know, acted like it was a Westworld kind of thing. So she had a video today revealing that she found out last week that she has a brain tumor. And it really kind of affected me. The video is something that I would encourage everybody to watch. But more specifically, I wanted to point out her Patreon, patreon.com/Simone Gertz. She's going to be unable to be making YouTube videos for as long as it takes for her to recover. And that's something that the tumor is benign. But she doesn't know exactly how long that's going to take. And Brian, I think it would be enlightening for everybody to have you, somebody who does not make all of his money on YouTube revenue, but YouTube revenue is a huge part of the equation, how scary it is or would be if all of a sudden your main way of making or a portion of that goes away, right?
Well, and... that is something, maybe this is an after things topic, but that is something that over the last couple of years, as the operation has grown and we have a lot of people who are all working together, you know, we realized first, like, oh man, it's really a bummer when Brian goes off to do a stage show because everything has to stop for those 3 to 4 days or whatever. And it's like, imagine if everything had to stop for 4 to 8 months during a medical, you know, terrifying thing. And it really has me in a place where I just want to empower, I want to diversify so that the engine doesn't have to shut down.
Because, yeah, like at the very least, you've had guests on Scam School that could theoretically take over. Jason is one half of the Modern Rogue, and Jason could kind of shift into a lead role for a little bit.
Her
job is her. It's her and a camera, and she's not only the builder, she's also the main personality. So here's all I'll say. Independent content creation is something that we talk a lot about, not only on this show, but on After Things. And if you believe in this as not only a fan of hers, but also just in general, this is the time to coalesce and throw a little coin for somebody that is going to rely on this, as she kind of goes through something really serious. So, I don't really know. I went to a party at her house once. I met her once. She is an incredibly sweet person, at least while I walked through her house. So this is primarily just me looking at that and seeing not only my own possible future, but also the future of so many, all of my closest friends. And so it definitely is something that I wanted to direct attention to. So patreon.com/ SIMONEGIERTZ.
Yeah. I have a pick. It's not as heavy. Netflix has had a bunch of new stuff come out, including the second season of a show I really, really enjoyed last year. And that is the Brazilian Netflix original 3%. It's back, baby. It takes place in this sort of semi post-apocalyptic world where when people turn 20, they go through the process, which is this big test, and only 3% of the young adults who go through this process are succeed and are allowed to go live in the offshore.
Basically paradise, and everyone else is, you know, the 97% hoi polloi.
Right, and it's life in the mainland is dirty and
nasty, brutish, and short.
It's tough. It's a tough life, and so the first season you follow a group of kids as they go through the process, and season two really, I think, is delivering in a way I didn't expect, in that it is showing us what happens after, both on and off the mainland. So I really recommend you check that out. It's 3% on Netflix. I think if you kind of like that Hunger Games or Maze Runner-y sort of aesthetic of like young,
beautiful young people walking in white hallways wearing jumpsuits.
Well, I mean, check this out. This is a little more mature, I would say, than like a typical young adult sort of series. So if you want something with a little more meat, 3% has a lot of that. It's got politicking and subterfuge and spies and stuff. It's very cool. That's going to do it here for us here at the Weird Things Podcast. Brian, Justin, thank you very much.
How's it been?
It's been weird.
Hey! Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.